It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll ask for your thoughts on what Wisconsin looks and sounds like to the rest of the country.
First, Wisconsin has seen 44 cases of a rare and often antibiotic-resistant bacteria infecting the bloodstream, with about 18 known fatalities. The bacteria is rare, so the CDC reported that there's no national surveillance for it. It's hard to tell how often and how many people are usually affected by it. Disease detectives from the CDC recently got involved to investigate how and why the Elizabethkina bacteria is affecting Wisconsinites in particular.
Dr. Nasia Sufdar joins us now. She's the Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics and faculty at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Sufdar, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, first, tell us, what do we know so far about Elizabethkina?
So Elizabethkina is a group of bacteria that, you know, are not common causes of infections in the general public. Most of the time when we hear about them, it's in the setting of sporadic cases, usually in a hospital or a healthcare facility, and often in the setting of a patient who is very vulnerable and frail or has other illnesses that render them susceptible to infection by this group of bacteria.
And what do we know about the group of bacteria?
So they are considered gram-negative, which is just a way to categorize bacteria by the type of stain that they take up in the lab, you know, when one is working them up. So these particular ones stain pink with this stain called the gram stain, and hence they're called gram-negative. They are often resistant to many antibiotic agents, but that being said, there are treatment options available, but often it might mean, you know, doing a combination of antibiotics rather than one. Those are the distinguishing features.
And as I understand it, this bacteria is found a lot, kind of all over the place, in the soil. It can live on people's bodies. But how does it typically get into the body, and how might a person pick up that infection?
So usually, yes, just as you mentioned, it's ubiquitous in the environment and water and other sources that are around us. But because it's not very virulent, meaning that it doesn't attack the normal host, it only causes infections if one's immune system is unable to cope with the entry of a pathogen. So, you know, immunocompromised, organ transplant, dialysis patients, that sort of thing, or other illnesses. Those individuals are more vulnerable. Some people may have it be in their sputum, but they're just colonized. It's not causing infection in that instance most often. So usually it's in the setting of healthcare, it's some procedure or device or administration of some fluid that causes individuals to get it.
Now, the CDC is now involved in trying to sort out where this particular outbreak, where the source is. So it tells us that this is something that's a little bit rare outside the norm. How unusual is this kind of outbreak?
It is very unusual. You know, most of the time we'll see very sporadic cases, maybe one or two a year, if that, in this, and most of them are in the context of some association with a healthcare facility. Here, many seem to be occurring in the community. It's a single state, but yet multi-county outbreak, so, and it's the largest of its kind thus far, so those things make it very challenging.
It sounds as though some of the people who were infected were not people who left home very often or were not in healthcare facilities, so how does the CDC go about trying to solve this question about where it's coming from?
Well, I mean, some avenues of inquiry might be going to the homes of those individuals and sampling the usual suspects, so water sources, other, looking at their medications, what they might be receiving internally that could be contaminated with Elizabethkina, for example. Those are some of the things people would wonder about.
And again, this is affecting primarily people with compromised immune systems, but what are the symptoms? What should people be on the lookout for if they are someone in that group?
Well, usually it's not a subtle finding. You know, people will start to feel quite ill. Most of the severe infections are in the bloodstream. So with bloodstream infections, you will often get fever, shaking chills. If the infection is in a particular body site, like the skin, you might see redness or inflammation of the skin. If it's a pneumonia, you might get respiratory symptoms. But it's not something that I would consider to be a low-grade or subtle infection. It's usually fairly significant and fairly apparent.
And there are 44 cases, 18 deaths due to this bacteria. And you said this is treatable, combinations of antibiotics with other treatments. But what do people need to know about what their chances are and how dangerous this thing is if they pick it up?
Well, I think a lot depends on the underlying illness. So Elizabethkina, you know, getting that on top of what else you might be battling certainly doesn't help anyone's cause. But because these individuals who have gotten this infection have already been fairly ill to begin with, that seems to be a major contributing factor to the death rate rather than the presence of the bacteria itself, although it may contribute. So treatment options are available, and there are combinations that can be used. But sometimes the underlying illnesses are not readily amenable to modification. You know, if your immune system is compromised, there's not much that can be done about it urgently. So because of that, people fare worse than what one might otherwise think.
We're talking right now with Dr. Nasia Safdar, Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. And we're talking about the recent outbreak of the bacterial illness Elizabethkina. And that's a word most of us have not been familiar with. Can you tell us a little bit about, I don't know, sort of the background, the origins of this bacteria and where it may originally have gotten identified?
Well, so it used to be called by different names. You know, molecular diagnostic testing methods have come a long way. So before, bacteria were grouped differently, and now we have more sophisticated ways of grouping them. So it used to be called Flavobacterium or Chrysiobacterium, which were still rare, but infectious diseases physicians were familiar with those terms. And now that we know more about the specifics of it, it's now got its own Elizabethkina terminology. But it's named after a scientist at CDC who identified it. Elizabethkina.
And it sounds as though so far this outbreak is limited to Wisconsin, this particular, at least wherever we are in the development of it. But do we expect it to be seen in other states as well?
You know, it's been going on for a while, almost several months at this point. So I would have thought if it was a multi-state, it would have become apparent by now. So I don't think that we will see that.
In terms of prevention, people may be listening, going, well, how do I protect myself? Is it the usual sort of hand-washing thing, or are there other things that people could do to prevent it?
You know, I think the general public really need not worry about it because, like I said, even though it's everywhere in the environment, it infects a very, very small proportion of people. And I think the action really needs to be on the side of healthcare providers and facilities to immediately detect and identify it and then report it to the Division of Public Health to aid them in their investigation in whatever way one can. For the general public, I mean, hand hygiene never hurts, but I don't know that that's the really crucial factor in this particular outbreak. It doesn't seem to be.
Well, I think we'll leave it there. Dr. Nasia Safdar, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Nasia Safdar is a medical director of infection control at UW Hospital and Clinics and faculty at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, talking to us there about the recent outbreak of the bacterial illness Elizabethkina.
In our conversations about how to best care for aging parents, one voice often gets left out, the aging parents. We know about the crunch middle-aged caregivers are feeling looking after their own kids and their parents, but we might not be used to asking those parents themselves, how do they feel about being cared for and cared about? What works for them and what makes them feel less in control of their own lives?
Our next guest decided it was time to give aging parents a voice in that conversation. Claire Berman is a contributor to The Atlantic Magazine, and she's the author of Caring for Yourself While Caring for Your Aging Parents. Claire, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, why did you decide that it was time to get the perspective of aging parents in this conversation about caregiving and caring about people as they age?
Well, Veronica, when I wrote the book that you mentioned, I was a caregiver. I was caring for my aging mother and for a mother-in-law, and I was very much that sandwich generation. But time passed, and I became an aging parent, and I saw everything from a different perspective. It was I had never interviewed the older parents themselves about what they wanted and what they were looking forward to and what irked them.
And I don't think you're alone in that. I mean, there are a lot of books out there like this. We've done a lot of interviews on this show about this topic, but I don't think we have really maybe ever talked about what exactly those parents themselves want and what they're feeling. Why do you think that is?
Because I think everything is slanted toward the caregiver who has a terrible job, a very difficult emotional job and practical job, but the older people are marginalized.
And how do you think we start changing that, turning that around?
Listen to people like me. And that is, you ask questions rather than decide for someone what they need. We're talking about people who can do a lot for themselves. Unfortunately, as you well know, many people need the intervention and intercession of their adult children because they're incapable of managing either physically or because they have some mental deficits. And they need help. But we're talking about a large number of people who are quite able to run their lives fairly well, may have more physical issues than they have mental issues. They're sharp as can be, but they may need some help.
And you started by talking to your own friends about how they felt, and you exchanged stories. What kinds of things did your friends tell you?
Well, for example, a child comes to visit the parent. The parent is delighted to have the child come and visit, but notices the child looking to see if the house is really clean. Are the groceries past their due date? Is there anything missing quite there? So you see that someone is not just visiting, but assessing on the visit. And that doesn't strike people as very kind.
How does it feel when that happens? Does it make the aging parent doubt themselves, or does it drive a wedge between the parent and the child?
It doesn't drive a wedge, because what we're talking about, Veronica, are ambivalent relationships, nothing cut and clear. You love your child. You want them to be there when you need them, but you don't want them to be there when you don't need them. So what it does is make you more wary, W-A-R-Y, maybe W-E-A-R-Y as well.
And so, why do you think this often gets unsaid in this dynamic? You just mentioned a couple scenarios. A child comes over, checks to see if the place is clean, if the refrigerator has food cleared out of stuff that's past its sell-by date. But a lot of these things, you know, they don't get talked about. What is going on there that both sides maybe feel that they can't really voice their concerns?
You're absolutely right. They can't really voice it. The parent is wanting to hold on to whatever control he or she still has. We can talk shortly about taking away someone's driving license. But the parent wants to hold on to whatever control they have, and the child is wresting control from the parent, but not feeling quite comfortable doing so. And so we have to learn how to talk to one another.
Well, it's an interesting time of life, right, where the roles are not reversed, but they're moving in a slightly different direction. The wheel is maybe starting to turn in the other direction in terms of who's caring for whom and who's, you know, accepting maybe more of the burden, and that's a difficult time. What do you suggest for acknowledging that moment and helping both parties to feel okay?
Well, I think we need some candor on the part of the older parent. Instead of magical thinking, my son really ought to know that picking up the groceries for the holidays is just too big a job for me, and he should have volunteered to help me. You say to your son, we can use some help. See, this is a big admission. We can use some help in picking up the groceries for Thanksgiving dinner. Could you come by and help us out? That's a statement rather than he should have known, he should have asked. And for the child, instead of coming on strong, what I learned is from my research and people I spoke with, plant an idea, say something, and then step back. Don't impose everything, but plant an idea and step back and see how your parent reacts. Give it time. It takes time.
So you might say something like, you were using that example of the driver's license, saying, you know, I've been wondering if you're at your safest behind the wheel, wondering how you feel about that. Maybe we can talk about that another time and then let it sit there. Both sides get time to digest it, and then you come back to it. Is that how it would work?
That would be. I'm a little concerned about your driving. You can have someone, if you're really concerned, you can involve a doctor to see that someone has a driving test, or a doctor recommends that the parent be tested. But you can just say, I'm worried about you driving at night. How do you feel about driving at night? That's generally the way it begins, the nighttime driving. Oh, I feel fine about it. Well, I'm a little concerned. Would you do me a favor and try not to drive at night? And then drop it. Don't make it this order. You're going to stop driving. Of course, there's a safety matter here. And so you have to have tests. And when there's safety involved, you have to take away the keys. But that's really a very difficult thing to do and often not necessary.
We're talking right now with Claire Berman, a contributor to The Atlantic, talking about her article looking at what aging parents want and need from their adult children. And you talked about staying away from magical thinking on the part of the parent in this case. Is there a tendency there to assume that your child is going to see your need and is going to respond to it without you having to say it out loud?
It's possible. But if it's important to you, you have to learn to articulate what's important. By the same token, if someone is doing much too much for you and you feel they're in your space, you can say, look, I can do this and I want to do this, and be very clear about what you want to do.
Do you think that's something most aging parents are comfortable doing? I can imagine that
Nope. Pride
could get in the way. You don't want to admit it. It's hard.
It is very difficult, and that's why we're having this discussion, I think, and why I wrote the article, because I was hearing from any number of my friends that they were feeling infantilized in some way, by a tone of voice that we used to them or the way someone took over aspects of their life when they didn't feel it was necessary. Underline that, when they felt it wasn't necessary. If someone can't balance a checkbook, you may have to take over the checkbook. But we're not talking about that, Veronica. We're talking about people who can do, but more slowly.
And you talked in your article about, you talked to a friend who said that she actually was, her daughter had moved to town, and you said, oh, isn't it great, you're getting to see each other. But she said, well, I'm actually looking to distance myself a little because there is too much infantilizing going on.
Right.
So apparently that does happen sometimes. What did you tell that friend in that moment?
I listened to her carefully and said, I'm sorry to hear that, but I know what you mean. And I knew about not everything. I didn't have my kids come over and check the state of my home. I don't go check the state of their homes, thank goodness. it works two ways. But I did notice a kind of checking the groceries, checking the dates, kind of being observed.
And you're a parent. You've got three sons, and you do say, yeah, I see them coming over and looking in my fridge. How have you navigated those waters with your own family?
I've said, stop looking at my groceries. I don't like it when you do that.
And do they?
And yes, they do it again, but we've made a joke of it. Mm. But I'm not joking.
So it's a joke to them, maybe not so much to you.
Right, right.
Do you think you did get to a place, though, where they're respecting you and respecting your wishes and your space and your abilities, basically?
For the most part, I think that's true, but I think it's true for most older people. They have the feeling when their children kind of try and take over of being both annoyed and feeling loved by their concern. It's not an easy call. It's not black or white. It's shades of relationships, and that's what we're talking about, being aware that the parents are going through a tough time and trying to hold on, being aware that the kids mean the best and are trying to take care.
We're talking right now with Claire Berman. She's a contributor to The Atlantic. Her article about what aging parents want from their adult children is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Are you an aging parent with adult kids? Do you let them know how you feel, what you want from them? Do you ever feel yourself distancing yourself from your grown kids because you feel like, hey, they're always looking over your shoulder, doing things that you can do for yourself? Or do you welcome the help they give you? And if you're the adult child in this situation, how does this all look from your perspective? Are you able to talk about these issues in your family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking right now with Claire Berman. She's a contributor to The Atlantic magazine, and her article about what aging parents want from their adult children is up on the Central Time Facebook page. She says, you know, she wrote a book about what the caregivers are going through and how to take care of themselves, but we haven't often talked. We don't usually talk about what the parents are feeling, what they want, and the best way to help them.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is this an issue you dealt with in your family, or is it an issue maybe you haven't successfully dealt with? If you're the parent or the adult child, is there conflict over who does what, over taking over responsibilities, over looking over the shoulder? Have you had a conversation about what works for each of you, what doesn't? Do both of you in this equation feel like your needs are being met, your wants are being respected? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Claire, do you think that even though this is a time that can be difficult, these can be kind of difficult waters to navigate, is it also a time that has potential opportunity for parents and children to come closer in maybe different ways than they're used to being together?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The adult children are valued. And the adult children who see their parents' lifespan shorter, coming to an end at some point soon, can value their parents and the time they spend with them. This better communication that I'm talking about only aims to improve the relationship, not to make it worse.
Let's take a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Pat on the line in West Bend. Pat, hi.
Hi. I guess I am a caregiver for my parents. My father passed about a year ago. And I guess my comment, thank you. I guess my comment is, and now my mother's widow. But anyway, I guess my comment is, I wish we had talked about this more when my father was alive, and even years ago before my parents became sick and ill and so on and needed caregiving, on just what exactly needed to be done and how it should be done and so on. I think it's important to have those discussions way ahead of time before the need arises as to what roles, what parts everyone is supposed to play, and making decisions medically and making decisions financially long before that time comes. I definitely encourage anybody to do that. Also, I don't know if you touched on this in your show earlier. I just tuned it in a few minutes ago. The roles of siblings and extended family members and so on, and dealing with that and dealing in dividing the workload that way, it can cause a lot of, difficulties and a lot of bad feelings if that's not discussed and if people don't pick up their parts and do their parts and so on.
Pat, thanks a lot. I appreciate your points there. Some good things to talk about. And Pat saying these conversations need to happen maybe before things are not falling apart, but a little more urgent. Is there a better time to have these? Because these are not maybe necessarily the most fun conversations for anybody. So how do you get into that conversation space, Claire?
Well, you keep it light, first of all. If you're not having a big family sit-down meeting, you bring it as part of the conversation. The caller spoke about relationships with siblings, and that's dealt with at great length in my book because that's addressing the caregiver. And how do you deal with the siblings, because nobody does a shared role of caregiving. There's going to be one primary caregiver among the kids. And how you deal with it and how you accept that is a really important topic. We could do a whole show on that. Mm. But should we talk ahead of time with our parents and say, what do you want? And the best scenario, how would you like me to be involved? Yes, I think those discussions should take place.
Well, thanks a lot for your call, Pat. And we're going to go next to Michelle, joining us from Racine. Michelle, hi.
Hi. I helped take care of my dad when he was getting older, and he wanted to be very independent. He didn't want to go live anyplace else. So we tried to do as much as we could to help him. But once he got sicker and sicker and he went to the hospital, we found out that he really needed a lot more help. So we tried to understand and tried to give him as much independence as we could, but it was really hard to try to balance that.
It is very hard. It's very hard. And what parents want is to be cared about, but they fear being cared for. Comes a time when they have to be cared for, and they're very grateful that you're there.
And what about that moment, where maybe a parent and a child realize that there is more care here that is needed, maybe more than that parent actually wants, but maybe it's a time that they have to accept it. How would
then you've got to do it.
So just go straight forward at
that
issue.
Well, if you're going to move someone to a nursing home or an adult residence, you want to involve them as best you can into what their preferences are. Is there a choice when they're still well? Should we go visit a place now in case you need it? Get them as involved as you can, as long as you can.
Well, Michelle, thanks so much for that call. Appreciate it. And a little bit, Claire, let's get into the sibling thing that you were mentioning. What is a good way to navigate how the division of labor works when you've got a bunch of siblings and a parent who needs caring for?
My feeling about that is you decide how much you can do, and then you don't have a fight with your siblings. You go out and find the people, places, and programs that can help you. You waste too much time in being annoyed, angry, whatever strong word I can come up with your siblings. We're not going to give care equally. Accept it and do the best you can, and then go out and find the people who can help you.
I mean, that's so hard. You hear from so many people that I'm doing the lion's share of the work, and so-and-so has only
flown
up once.
That's what you hear all the time, don't you?
Yeah.
Don't do it. It takes up too much energy, and you're not going to accomplish anything with it.
You got to do something with those emotions, though, don't you? If you're feeling angry.
Sure, you can go speak to someone about that, those emotions. But you waste too much time in being angry when it's not going to work out well. What you have to do is say, this is what I can do. The other thing you can't do, if you've got a moment, is you don't accuse the other person. You don't say, I took Mom to the doctor 3 times, and you've never shown up at all. You say, Mom has these appointments on these particular days. I can do these 2. I'll need someone from your family to help out on the 3rd. It's a statement, not a complaint.
Does it seem to work as far
yep.
as you know? difficult things for families to sort out, but some good starting points there. Claire, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That was Claire Berman, a contributor to The Atlantic magazine. She joined us there to talk about what aging parents want from their grown children. And we've got an article she wrote about that topic. She talked to some of her friends, talked to some experts, and that article is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
And you can share your stories. Still time for you to do that. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know maybe some advice that you've learned as the aging parent, as the adult child of that parent, in resolving conflicts, who does what, and respecting the needs of each other. Again, that's at the Central Time Facebook page.